In State v. Carter, decided 1988, the North Carolina Supreme Court held that the state constitution includes an exclusionary rule, requiring the exclusion of evidence obtained in violation of a defendant's rights against unreasonable search and seizure, and that the state constitution does not include a good faith exception. The North Carolina Supreme Court has now explicitly overruled Carter, holding that there is a good faith exception to any exclusionary rule arising from the state constitution. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Rogers, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina. John, before we get to the good faith exception, there was another case about how defendants can obtain body camera footage in the custody of law enforcement agencies. Tell us about Chimudi.
Yeah, Joe, I am also very interested in talking about that good faith exception case. But first, we did want to talk about State versus Chimudi. This is one I think that's significant for prosecutors, especially district court prosecutors. And we want to talk about what it says and also what we think it doesn't say. But this was an opinion that we got from the North Carolina Supreme Court on October 17th. It originally came out of Iredell County. And what's at issue here is this statute, General Statute 132-1.4a. This is a statute that we got back in 2016 related to law enforcement agency recordings. So, you know, dash cams, body cams, things like that recorded by an agency. And that statute sets up a specific procedure for how a defense attorney or anyone else can compel the release or the disclosure of those videos, which involves going to Superior Court and getting an order. That's the procedure that's laid out in the statute. Something different happened in this case. It arose out of a case from back in 2023 when law enforcement officers arrested the defendant Chimudi for resisting a public officer. And prior to trial, Chimudi served a subpoena on the police department asking for any body cam videos showing the incident, arrest, and incarceration. So the town basically filed a written response to that saying, this is not the right way to do it. You know, you don't serve a subpoena on us. We have this statute. You're supposed to go and get a court order. So they argued that the subpoena was basically asking for the release of confidential recordings that are protected by the statute, and that the statute is the only way that those can be obtained. The town's response to that was basically denied by the district court. About a week after that response, without any notice to the town, the Chimudi filed a request for the district court to order the release of the body camera recordings, and the district court, again, without any notice to the town, granted that motion, finding that what the written response from the town was not really a proper motion to quash the subpoena. So then the town responds to that. They do file this written motion to quash with the court. The town also notes that under the statute, they're supposed to be given a right to notice and have an opportunity to come in and be heard in Superior Court about this release. But the trial court again denies that. They reject the town's response again, rejecting the argument that the statute 132-1.4a is the only way to obtain that information. In other words, that's one way you could do it, but also this is a pending case and this defense attorney can file a subpoena. So the town appealed that ruling to the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals dismissed it for lack of appellate jurisdiction, basically saying this is just an ongoing matter in trial court. There's really nothing for us to act on here. So then the town files a petition for writ of cert to the North Carolina Supreme Court, asking them to rule on it. So that's the first thing that the North Carolina Supreme Court talks about, saying we do think this is properly before us and something that needs to be ruled on now. Because per the statute, these are essentially confidential law enforcement records. And, you know, it would be an insufficient remedy for a person later on down the road to say, remember when you forced me to disclose this confidential stuff? That was a mistake. They say this is something that needs to be addressed and resolved now. And actually, Joe, there's kind of another interesting procedural wrinkle here where they say normally the procedure would be for us to say Court of Appeals erred in saying they did not or should not address this matter, so we're going to remand it back down to them. But the Supreme Court takes the extra step of saying this is an important and significant issue. We're just going to go ahead and address it on the merits. And so then that finally gets us into talking about the kind of the meat of the case. They begin with the statute, the 132-1.4a, talk about how goal of statutory construction is to carry out the intent of the legislature. And they note that per the statute, these recordings are no longer public records, right? These are protected. These are confidential agency recordings that they've got. And there is a clear procedure set out in the statute for how a person can go get it. under 132-1.4AF. If a person wanted to compel the production of that, they can file a motion in Superior Court to try to get a court order from the Superior Court judge to disclose those recordings. And when the judge gets that, the statute even sets out this list of 8 different factors that the court is supposed to consider. For example, the release is necessary for a compelling public interest, or the information is otherwise confidential, things like that. So they review the requirements under the statute. And they point out that the statute emphasizes that the recordings cannot be released without this necessary court order. That is the way to obtain it. And they explain that this is sort of what the crux of the argument here is. It is this last bit of statutory language authorizing release, quote, pursuant to a court order, end quote, that is the crux of the party's dispute in this case. In other words, the defendant is arguing, sure, there's a statute that says if you want this, you can go to Superior Court. You may go to Superior Court and get a court order for the release. But a court order in Superior Court is not the only kind of court order. The defendant is arguing, if I go get an order from a district court judge that says, give me this stuff, that's a valid court order, or even a subpoena, right? I mean, a subpoena in a pending case could be a court order. The Supreme Court rejects that. They say that Chimuti's argument is undermined by the very next sentence in the statute where it talks about, yes, it can be released pursuant to a court order, but the next sentence explains how to obtain that court order. And the way you obtain it is by going into Superior Court, presenting it to a Superior Court judge, and satisfying that judge under these 8 criteria that it needs to be released. And so they say that is the only way that it may be done is pursuant to that statute and going in and getting a Superior Court order. The Supreme Court acknowledges, they say, basically, we get it. I mean, you know, we understand that this is creating a essentially a procedural hurdle to get this stuff that the prosecutor doesn't have to do, right? The cops are going to hand it over, and we'll talk about that. Nor would a defense attorney in Superior Court, since presumably they would just be getting it all in discovery. But they say that was the legislature's decision to make about what the scope of the protection would be, who would be able to get it easily, just sort of hand it over by law enforcement or in discovery, versus who would have to go to Superior Court and actually get it pursuant to a court order. But they say the statute expressly limits this release only to the district attorney's use in district court or for other law enforcement purposes, or, you know, indirectly to a defense attorney in Superior Court. And they say, we acknowledge this places a burden on criminal defendants in district court that is not placed on district attorneys or on criminal defendants in Superior Court, but that is an outcome the General Assembly intended when it drafted these protections for the recordings now deemed confidential. But it does sort of tee up a second argument in the case, which is, okay, well, if I'm a defense attorney, right, I have a right to present a complete defense. And this is kind of making it hard for me to go get stuff that I might be able to use in the defense of my case. And the Supreme Court disagrees with that as well. They basically say this is not rising to the level of some constitutional error of denying you the ability to present your case. In other words, if the defense attorney thinks I need this to defend the case, you can still get it. I mean, you can still go and petition for this order. And assuming you've met the criteria, like showing a compelling need for access to it, you'll get that court order and be able to use it. It may be a little bit more of a procedural burden or a procedural hassle, but it's not such a burden placed on your ability to defend yourself that they think it rises to that level of interfering with his ability to defend the case. So that is sort of the core holding of the case, right? Is this foundational ruling of no, a defense attorney in district court cannot issue a subpoena to the custodial law enforcement agency saying, give me that dash or body cam video. Joe, the reason I really thought we wanted to talk about it in this episode is because we've gotten a lot of questions from prosecutors. What if I'm the ADA in district court and I have a dash cam video of a DWI stop or something? Is Chimuti saying you cannot give it to the defense attorney unless we have a Superior Court order?
Right, because there's language in there, at least from which somebody might infer that this is an exclusive avenue for obtaining these recordings, right? That if the defendant wants these, this is how he has to go about it to get those recordings. So, right, the question is, does this preclude prosecutor in district court from making those recordings available when he or she wishes to do that?
Look, I'm not on the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, but I don't think that it does. And the reason I say that is because this statute, 132-1.4A, is talking about a defense attorney or anybody else's ability to compel production from the agency. And that's not what we're talking about. When the prosecutor is standing there in district court holding the DVD or the thumb drive and saying, I am interested in making a voluntary disclosure to the defense attorney. I think it would save everybody time. I can show you how badly he did on these field sobriety tests. It's in your best interest to work out a plea with me instead of going to trial on this. Let me show you why I think that's true. I think once it's been given to the prosecutor, now we're under 132-1.4, no capital A, subsection G. That's the provision that talks about once law enforcement records or files or investigative materials have been given to the prosecutor, they're still not public records, but they're just subject to the disclosure requirements or options under 15A, you know, in general. In other words, that's why we can give this stuff over in discovery to the defense attorneys. And by the same token, I would say it is not a public record in the sense that somebody without a court order can come demand that I give you something from my file. But I don't think that statute says that I can't give you something from my file if I think that's the right thing to do in the interest of justice. And I think that's even backed up here. You know, that streamlined process they talked about for giving it to the prosecutors, law enforcement giving it to the prosecutors, it sort of lists out in these little Romanettes about the reasons or the purposes for which they can give it over. And one of those is, it's flat out says, for use in criminal proceedings in district court. And so, I mean, even if there was some issue about can the cop give it to me knowing that my intent or my purpose in getting it from him is to turn around and give it to the defense attorney, I would say yes. I mean, I think making a voluntary discovery disclosure in district court for purposes of plea negotiations or something like that, I feel pretty comfortable arguing that's a legitimate and valid use of it in district court. And so I think it could be handed over. There is a dissent in this case.
The other question is, I mean, who's going to complain if that's how the defendant gets the materials, right? How is that going to become a litigable issue?
I don't think the defendant would be arguing against the fact that you made a voluntary disclosure. But, you know, Joe, that's the other maybe final or closing point I would make for the prosecutors is I would just stress to you that it's kind of important to remember that even if it is true that we can give this stuff over in district court, I don't think that means we always should be handing the stuff over in district court, especially if we've only had a limited opportunity to, you know, really review it ourselves. Is there a confidential informant whose identity is going to be revealed on here? Does this video have private, intimate images of a victim? You know, we need to make sure we're not setting an expectation that just because we can, that means we're automatically handing it over in every single case. I think it's a case-by-case decision. We want to exercise our discretion and judgment and, you know, certainly talk to your elected DA about how they feel about district court discovery. But in particular cases, if we think it's warranted, then I think this case would not say that those rules are different for us than they were. There was a dissent in this case from Justice Riggs, joined by Justice Earls. I think they just take a different view of the statute, you know, that they would view it more along the lines of saying where it says you may go to Superior Court does not mean you must go to Superior Court. They also have some additional concerns about whether there might be exculpatory material in some of these recordings. And again, that's an important factor for prosecutors to consider, even in district court, where we don't have statutory discovery obligations. If there's exculpatory Brady material, you know, we need to make sure we're checking and being aware of that. And certainly in those cases, we would want to hand it over for those reasons. But that's sort of our big takeaway, is that I don't think defense attorneys can compel it by subpoena, but I don't think it means prosecutors can't voluntarily disclose it if they think that's appropriate. And Joe, that then brings us to the one we were forecasting in the introduction, State versus Rogers. I think this is one of the biggest ones we've had.
State v. Rogers, yeah. This is a big case decided by the North Carolina Supreme Court about the meaning of a state constitutional provision. This is a case out of New Hanover County, decided by the North Carolina Supreme Court on October 17th, 2025. The facts that gave rise to this case are these. Back in July of 2019, a confidential informant told New Hanover Sheriff's Office that defendant was trafficking in cocaine. Detective Donald Wenk with the New Hanover Sheriff's Office applied for an order authorizing a number of different things, a pen register and or a trace device, GPS and geolocation, and the production of records under 18 United States Code Section 2703. The trial court found probable cause and approved the application, ultimately allowing law enforcement to access defendant's cell site location information. That's an acronym that appears over and over again in this opinion, CSLI, cell site location information, for 60 days. Armed with that warrant, using that information, the police were able to observe that in August of 2019, defendant's cell phone left Wilmington, headed west. It arrived in Hayward, California, a few days later on August 20th, where it stayed for a total of 30 minutes and then began its trip back east to Wilmington, North Carolina. Police officers observed as defendant's vehicle crossed into North Carolina, and they conducted a traffic stop in New Hanover County, searched the defendant's vehicle. Inside the vehicle, officers found trafficking amounts of cocaine. Defendant was indicted for trafficking in cocaine and possession, trafficking by transportation, possession with intent to sell or deliver a Schedule II, and maintaining a vehicle for keeping or selling controlled substances. He filed a motion to suppress the evidence obtained from what he called the unlawful GPS tracking of his cell phone. The trial court denied the motion, finding there was reasonable suspicion for the Section 2703 order and for the traffic stop that ultimately where the officers found this cocaine in his vehicle. Defendant entered an Alford plea to trafficking cocaine and possession with intent to sell or deliver and appealed the denial of his motion to suppress. Before the Court of Appeals determined that Detective Wenk's application for this order was not supported by probable cause as required by the Fourth Amendment. That's a recent United States Supreme Court case called Carpenter that held these 2703 orders have to be supported by probable cause. The Court of Appeals considered but rejected the state's argument that the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule would permit the admission of this evidence, relying on that case that I started with, State v. Carter, back in 1988, where the North Carolina Supreme Court found there was no good faith exception under the exclusionary rule in our state constitution. The Court of Appeals consequently reversed the trial court's denial of defendant's motion to suppress and awarded the defendant a new trial, and then the state sought discretionary review from the North Carolina Supreme Court. The North Carolina Supreme Court opinion includes a lengthy discussion of the history of the exclusionary rule and the good faith exception. Very briefly, since 1776, the state constitution has prescribed the use of general warrants, that is, warrants that are not, that don't have a particularized description of the place or the person to be searched. The Fourth Amendment, coming later in 1791 to the U.S. Constitution, prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. The General Assembly in North Carolina enacted North Carolina's first statutory exclusionary rule in 1937. So in North Carolina, it actually was a product of statute before it was a product of any constitutional rule. The federal exclusionary rule, making evidence obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment inadmissible, was not made applicable to the states until 1961 with the case of Mapp v. Ohio. 1974, the General Assembly enacts 15A-974, which replaces the earlier statute and provides basically two bases for the suppression of evidence. One, if its exclusion is required by the Constitution, or two, if the evidence is obtained as a result of a substantial violation of Chapter 15A. Then in the 80s, the United States Supreme Court adopts a good faith exception to the federal exclusionary rule in a case called United States v. Leon, which allows evidence obtained in good faith reliance on a warrant, even where the warrant is subsequently found invalid. And then in State v. Carter, which was about 4 years later, the North Carolina Supreme Court declared that the state constitution contains a comparable exclusionary rule, but does not contain a good faith exception as the federal constitution does. So after that, these cases litigated in North Carolina meant if evidence is obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment, that requires the suppression of evidence, and that evidence can't be admitted despite that violation through any good faith exception. In 2011, the North Carolina General Assembly amended 15A-974 to provide a statutory good faith exception, and it also specifically requested the North Carolina Supreme Court to reconsider Carter. So that's kind of where we were from a legal history perspective when this case Rogers arrives at the North Carolina Supreme Court. So the North Carolina Supreme Court in Rogers first addressed the question of whether the good faith exception under General Statute 15A-974 would allow the admission of this evidence. They concluded that it would not, for the reason that the good faith exception as provided by statute is permissible only for evidence obtained as a violation of Chapter 15A. Obviously, for evidence obtained in violation of the Constitution, the legislature would not be empowered to grant an exclusion to a state constitutional rule. So at least in this case, the statutory good faith exception under 15A-974 is not going to allow this evidence to come in because the Court of Appeals found that the evidence was obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment. So the next question is whether the evidence should be suppressed under the federal constitution and under the state constitution. Addressing first whether the evidence should be suppressed under the federal constitution, North Carolina Supreme Court recognized that the federal constitution does not require the suppression here because the federal good faith exception allows evidence to be used that was obtained by officers acting in reasonable reliance on a warrant. Here, Detective Wenk's reliance on the Section 2703 order to obtain the CSLI data, that is, defendant's cell site location information, was reasonable. And as a result of that federal good faith exception, the North Carolina Supreme Court concluded that the evidence was not bound to be suppressed under the federal constitution. Turning next to the state constitution, the North Carolina Supreme Court concluded that the state constitution likewise does not require the suppression of the evidence. It looked at Article 1, Section 20 of the state constitution. That's the provision that prohibits general warrants. It noted that the state constitution does not, however, provide a remedy for a violation of that provision. It recognized that State v. Carter declared that the state constitution contains an exclusionary rule, but not a good faith exception, but it found some of the reasoning in Carter doesn't really hold up. For example, Carter pointed out that if a good faith exception were to be enacted, that would be the province of the legislature. But as the North Carolina Supreme Court pointed out here, if it was really an exclusionary rule required by the Constitution, that's not something that could be done merely by legislative enactment. So ultimately, the North Carolina Supreme Court, in this case, Rogers, expressly overrules Carter. And it ultimately holds that there is a good faith exception to any exclusionary rule arising under the state constitution. And then applying that state good faith exception, the North Carolina Supreme Court concluded that the exclusion of the CSLI data in this case was not required by the state constitution.
Joe, that was, to me, I think, one of the most surprising or interesting aspects of this whole decision, right? I mean, it sounds like they're looking at Carter, and I think the majority here is flat out saying, thus, as a matter of the constitutional text, Article 1, Section 20 does not require exclusion of such evidence at trial. They seem to be saying, at most, it is unclear whether we have an exclusionary rule at all.
Under the state constitution. Ultimately, I think the North Carolina Supreme Court is rejecting Carter's holding that the state constitution does contain an exclusionary rule, but they don't actually decide one way or the other about whether an exclusionary rule is mandated by the state constitution. They point out the parties haven't briefed that issue. We weren't really asked to decide that, so we don't need to decide today whether there is an exclusionary rule mandated by the state constitution. All Rogers really says is, to the extent there is any such exclusionary rule under the state constitution, North Carolina law also recognizes a good faith exception comparable to the good faith exception under the Fourth Amendment.
And that seems to be what the dissent is sort of getting worked up about. You know,
right.
We're basically saying, we don't even know if there is an exclusionary rule under the state constitution, but if there is one, we have a good faith exception to it. That's the ruling. And so I think prosecutors will say, we'll take it and we'll work with it, that we do now have good faith exception in North Carolina. But that's sort of an interesting way to get there.
Yeah, the dissent basically is a dissent written by Justice Earls, joined by Justice Riggs. And there's two main points of this very long dissent. The first was that Justice Earls in the dissent said that she would reaffirm Carter and hold that the state constitution requires an exclusion and contains no good faith exception. So there's sort of a full-throated endorsement of all the reasons that Carter was properly decided, these liberty interests and the reliance on the legitimacy of the judiciary and all this sort of thing. But then secondly, the dissent calls out the majority for what it calls this sort of incomprehensible analysis, that you can't decide that there's an exclusion to the rule without deciding there's a rule there or not. That was limited to a problem that the dissent had. As you pointed out, the majority has no problem in saying we don't need to decide whether there is an exclusionary rule required by the state constitution. All we're holding today is, to the extent there is any such rule, the state constitution recognizes a good faith exception equivalent to the good faith exception recognized by the United States Constitution for the Fourth Amendment. And then the other thing, Jonathan, that we had talked about briefly about this, I think this case is going to be of most relevance to prosecutors dealing with a situation where evidence has been obtained as a result of a warrant, and the defendant later on in a motion to suppress is challenging the affidavit supporting that warrant.
Right.
Right. By its terms, Rogers recognizes the good faith exception applies when an officer has found evidence in reasonable reliance on prior judicial authorization for a search. This is not going to apply in a case where you've got some other exception to the warrant requirement, where a search was justified by virtue of consent or automobile exception or something like that. This is going to be a situation where the officer has gone and gotten a warrant. They have obtained evidence during the execution of that warrant, and the defendant goes back later and challenges that warrant as not supported by probable cause.
You know, Joe, you make a really good point. I think a lot of North Carolina prosecutors, myself included, we're probably not as well-versed on the good faith exception as we should be, because it just hasn't really been something we could rely on very often. You had mentioned to me the other day about we sort of at most might have what I sometimes call the baby brother of the good faith exception, you know, that reasonable mistake of law or fact that we might be able to argue. But yeah, we might need to brush up on that and make sure we're clear on when it might apply or when it might be helpful or something we could argue. But I think you're exactly right. Those late challenges to the, hey, the judge never should have issued this warrant to begin with. Well, the officer reasonably relied on the fact that the judge did. And so we're just going to say that that evidence is not going to be excluded for that basis.
Yeah. And one final point about Rogers is there is a good discussion here about what the good faith exception is and what it means. It's not ironclad, right? The North Carolina Supreme Court recognizes that the good faith exception is ultimately premised on law enforcement reliance on judicial authorization. There are some incidences, however, when reliance on judicial authorization will not be objectively reasonable. And they list these four scenarios as recognized by the United States Supreme Court where that good faith exception is just not going to apply. One, where the officer gave the judge or magistrate information he knew was false or would have known was false except for his reckless disregard of the truth. That's a Franks claim. So an officer who lies to the magistrate and then gets a warrant to find evidence is not going to be able to say, look, I was just reasonably relying on the warrant, where the warrant was gotten by virtue of the officer's misrepresentation. The second, where the issuing magistrate wholly abandoned his judicial role as a neutral and detached arbiter. The third, where the officer's affidavit was so lacking in indicia of probable cause as to render official belief in its existence entirely unreasonable. And four, where a warrant is so facially deficient that the executing officers cannot reasonably presume it to be valid. And then the North Carolina Supreme Court spells that out as, that is, it fails to particularize the place to be searched or the things to be seized. So there are these four sort of, what do you want to call them, exceptions to the exceptions.
Right.
It's not kind of an ironclad guarantee, but it does provide this additional avenue for the state to introduce evidence, even when there's been a finding of a violation of the defendant's constitutional rights.
Well, that's a big one, Joe. I'm sure we'll have a lot more to talk about that in the weeks, months, and years ahead as we begin to get our appellate cases interpreting that and applying it for North Carolina. We just have a little bit of time left. I just wanted to briefly talk about one additional case, which was State versus Wilson, another one that we got from the North Carolina Supreme Court on October 17th of this year, a case out of Cleveland County. We don't get a whole lot of facts for this. They're not particularly relevant to this discussion. It's a defendant who's on trial for two counts of first-degree murder, one count of attempted first-degree murder, count of robbery with a dangerous weapon, and accounts of conspiracy to commit robbery with a dangerous weapon. The case is dealing with a Batson issue. The defendant arguing that during jury selection that the state was exercising peremptory challenges to excuse jurors for an improper reason based on race. Briefly to recap, when we're talking about a Batson challenge, what's happening here is if the defense attorney is objecting, making that argument that the state is excusing or challenging jurors on an improper basis, there's a three-step process that we go through. Step one is that the defendant making the objection first has to make a prima facie case to satisfy the judge that there was this improper race basis for the state excusing the jurors. That's the defendant's burden to come forward with. If that's met, then we move to step two, where the prosecutor would then offer their race-neutral reasons to explain why they were actually excusing these jurors that were not based on an improper consideration. That would be the prosecutor's burden. And then step three, the court would weigh all of that out and decide if the defendant has carried their burden of proving racial discrimination. Now, the reason I'm sort of setting all that up to begin with is because we've had some cases in the last few years where something has happened that they essentially refer to as the mootness of step one. If the defendant is essentially making the allegation in step one, before deciding whether they have or haven't even made that prima facie showing, sometimes in some of these cases, they were viewing it as essentially jumping ahead to step two and then step three because the prosecutor jumps up and starts giving their reasons prior to getting a ruling on whether we've even gotten past step one. And that's sort of what happens in this case, but not exactly. In this case, the state did exercise peremptory challenges to excuse two jurors. They were two Black female prospective jurors, juror number 9 and juror number 10. And after they were excused, the defense objected. The defense raised this Batson challenge, said, Your Honor, this is a Batson. So far, what I've seen is the state, I believe, has used two peremptory challenges. Both were African-Americans that she struck, especially the first juror. And so raising this challenge. And then when the Judge then turns to the state. The prosecutor essentially immediately begins doing what is kind of really a step two. The prosecutor begins explaining the reasons why she excused juror number 9 and juror number 10. There are reasons, sensible reasons, that are being offered. Juror number 9 seems to have some close relationship with a family member of the defendant sitting on the front row, something like that. Juror number 10 talks about being not particularly interested or not going to be able to pay attention to what's going on because of some comments that she had made. And so the judge makes some responsive comments about noticing some of those same things. But this is really what the case comes down to, is even though the prosecutor in this case jumped right into essentially step two of giving my race neutral reasons, what the judge said was, all right, I don't believe there's been a prima facie case for a Batson challenge. In other words, despite the fact that the prosecutor gave some information or arguments that we might call really step two, the trial judge, in the view of the majority, is still making a step one ruling of saying, I don't think the defense has even made a prima facie case. But that's ultimately what the Supreme Court is being asked to review here, because after all this was done, the jury was impaneled, the trial was held, the defendant was convicted of all charges, got 200 and some month sentence, and then he appeals. The Court of Appeals remanded this back down for a new Batson hearing, in their words, in light of the trial court's procession to Batson's third step and subsequent failure to conduct an analysis satisfactory under the procedural requirements established by State v. Hobbs. In other words, the Court of Appeals was looking at it as saying this is one of those mootness cases, you know, that you jumped over step one by hearing from the prosecutor. Now we're at step three. And if we're at step three, we need some step three level findings from you about why you're satisfied by the state's reasons that they offered. The Supreme Court is looking at it differently. Going back to the beginning of the opinion, they summarize it this way. We reverse the Court of Appeals judgment, remand, and reiterate that the mootness doctrine to Batson's three-step process is an exception to be applied cautiously, not a rule to be foisted upon every case in which the transcript does not reveal a surgically precise exchange between the parties and the trial court. There's a deeper discussion here. In the interest of time, I won't dig through all of it, but the Supreme Court does then go through this 1-2-3-step analysis and explains a little more detail what's involved and what's required. But that, I think, is really our big takeaway for the prosecutors, is they're saying, here, even though the prosecutor did jump into some step two, that doesn't automatically moot whether we are or are not still making the step one prima facie determination. And that the trial judge clearly did that here. The trial judge, despite what the prosecutor jumped into talking about, said that they were making a determination that the prima facie case had not even yet been made. And so they are sort of reversing it for that reason. Two points I will make here. The first of those is, I think there's some good language in here about how they say the appellate courts are going to show deference to the trial courts in making these determinations. You know, the trial judge is the one sitting right there observing these things. You know, for example, when the prosecutor was talking about how juror number 10 was yawning and seemed tired and worried that they won't pay attention, the judge made some offhand comment about, yeah, I noticed that too. You know, that would have been more of a step two discussion anyway, but I think that's just a really good example of why they try to show that deference to the trial courts.
Well, Jonathan, let me ask you, maybe I know the answer to this question. Whose job is it ultimately to determine like what stage we're in? I think all the parties would be better off if we were clear about where the boundaries are and kind of what level of the process we're going through, right? So it sounds like the Court of Appeals faulted the trial court with kind of jumping over one step to the next. But it sounds from what you're saying, like maybe the prosecutor also should kind of be aware not to move into step two before we've thoroughly investigated step one.
Joe, I think you hit the nail on the head. And there's even some discussion of that in here, you know, where they, I think the Supreme Court here in analyzing what happened in the sequencing, they sort of make that point of the trial judge can't control what the prosecutor does or doesn't say when you give them an opportunity to answer. And, you know, that's part of it too. The prosecutor absolutely can, and they stress this again here, the prosecutor absolutely can argue against step one. Before getting into my specific race-neutral reasons for why I would excuse somebody, I can stand up and argue against step one. And I would really encourage prosecutors to remember to do that. When they say, hey, I'm raising a Batson challenge because you excused juror 9 and 10, absolutely you should stand up. Whatever the judge says to you, even if the judge to you says, Mr. DA, tell me why you excused juror number 9 and juror number 10. Even if they called on you to do that.
It'd be better for the prosecutor to say, hold up, let me first make an argument for why there's not been a prima facie case, and then I will tell you my race-neutral reason.
Absolutely. I have very good reasons for that, Judge. But before we get into that, I don't think they've made that showing. You know, I mean, I excused juror 9 and 10, but look at these other people that I did not excuse. And then, you know, there's another person who's not of that race that I did excuse. You know, I mean, if they haven't even made the prima facie showing, then we stop there. And Joe, you and I have talked about this a couple times before. I would encourage prosecutors to do that for another reason as well, that if it is one of these mootness cases, you know, where we just don't argue step one, we move right into step two, giving our race-neutral reasons for excusing people, it is possible to get tripped up. You might explain that you excused juror number 10 for reason A, but in the heat of the moment, you don't even remember reasons B, C, and D. And then on appeal, they say, well, but you didn't excuse juror number 3, who also said something about A. And so, you know, we're going to find that's a pretextual reason being offered. It can be a minefield. I don't question at all that prosecutors have good reasons for excusing these people, but why even walk into that if there hasn't even been a showing at step one? And I think that's what this case is trying to stress for the prosecutors. Let's do it in sequence. So yeah, if the judge says, tell me your reasons, judge, I'm happy to do that. I don't think we've gotten past step one. We need a ruling on that. And before you give a ruling, let me give you my step one arguments about why I don't think they've made a showing. Once that ruling is made, then you say, fine, I do have good reasons. I excuse those people, hear where they are. And then at step three, the judge should make those determinations and hopefully find in the state's favor that there was a proper reason for excusing the jurors that were excused. So,
but I think there was a dissent in this case as well.
There was. There was also a dissent in this case. I think the dissent, which was written by Earls, she says, I dissent because the majority in the name of deference retreats from this court's already improperly cramped understanding of federal precedent to add formalistic requirements about what talismanic words a trial court must utter when a Batson objection is raised during trial. I think the majority sees it exactly the other way. They're saying, we are not going to, you know, apply some formalistic or, you know, in their words, we're not asking for surgical precision. You know, it didn't matter here, like we said a couple of times, didn't matter here that maybe the prosecutor did give some step two responses. Doesn't change the fact that we could still render a step one decision, you know, that it's not this talismanic or automatic things. The idea that we've gone so far down the road that we can't even make a step one determination, that mootness doctrine, in their words, is the exception, not the rule. So I guess our two takeaways for the prosecutors would be, add to the list of 10 million other things you're trying to keep at the top of your mind during a jury trial. But if this issue comes up, fight that instinct to immediately rebel against what can feel like an accusation that you're a racist. And people understandably want to stand up immediately and say, I absolutely am not. I have very good reasons I excuse these 2-3 people. We have to fight that and say, let's do step one, then we'll talk about step two, and then we'll get a decision at step three. And if there's a little bit of sloppiness or blending between those steps, that doesn't automatically mean it's been mooted.
Well, that's all the time we've got for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Chimudi, holding that defendants may not subpoena body cam footage in the custody of law enforcement agencies. State v. Rogers, overruling Carter and recognizing a good faith exception under the state constitution. And State v. Wilson, concluding that step one of the Batson analysis was not moot simply because the prosecutor volunteered a race-neutral reason for peremptory challenges. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We're coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helped.